couple of years ago, some students on retreats that I was leading asked me why I didn't teach loving kindness practice at the retreat. It's quite common in this tradition when you go on a mindfulness retreat or an insight or Vipassana retreat that once a day or once a week or whatever, they'll offer some instruction in loving kindness or metta. And while I know how to practice metta and teach metta and loving kindness, I don't usually teach it in mindfulness retreats, but it got me to thinking about love and the role it plays in our life. So I got thinking about it, and then when I had to choose a topic for this weekend a year ago, I said, okay, now's the time. I'm going to put my mind to it and try to dredge up all of those love experiences that I remember and am currently experiencing and talk about it. So tonight I want to speak about what we conventionally know as love. Not just metta. In fact, I want to talk about all the forms of love that we do experience or have experienced or would like to experience that is not metta. Metta is that universal loving kindness and well-wishing for all beings. But what I want to talk about tonight is how we experience love with baggage. That's what I call it. So every day we are bombarded with images and talk and options and opportunities for romance and passion and desire and love and sex and everything that's associated with what conventionally we would call love, or what we hope is love. And let's face it, we have all experienced a lot of love. We have received a lot of love from others. We've offered a lot of love to others. We've been disappointed in love. We've been curious about love. We've been fascinated by love. We've been hurt by love gone bad. And for all of our experience, it still is a mystery. It still is a little bit of like, how does it happen and how does it arrive so suddenly and unexpectedly at times, and where does it go when it goes? And for many of us too, there is the love of course, our children or grandchildren, a love of our aging parents, our partners, a love for students, appropriate love, I should say, a love of teachers. There's just a wide range of experiences that we call love. We could even say, I love chocolate mousse. But what I want to talk about is the kinds of love that we experience that sometimes cause us pain, sometimes cause us suffering, sometimes confuse us, because this is what we really experience. We can practice, and we should, learn to practice loving kindness, metta, to develop that capacity for universal love for all beings. That's fine. But let's face it, a lot of our love relationships or love experiences aren't that. They come with expectation, and sometimes we don't know, is this really love, or is this genuine love, or is this love with baggage? Most of the time in Dharma circles like this, or spiritual practices like this, when we hear of romantic love or passionate love, it is kind of shunted off to the side as somehow contaminated with desire or sex or, you know, lust, and it's not the real thing. And I think that that's kind of an unfair judgment, because even in those kinds of romantic and passionate love relationships, there can be a lot of love. There can be a lot of really sincere caring and concern for the other, even if there is also a lot of fascination, attraction, attachment. But as they say, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. I'm going to try to talk about it, not to teach you or tell you anything that you don't already know, because let's face it, we've all been through the gamut. But what I want to do is try to tease out some of the elements of love and some of the elements of the baggage of love, and see how it is that we can be aware of them. So really what I'm teaching is awareness of love and its baggage, not teaching you about love itself. Because to the extent that we really see for ourselves in our own experience what love is and what the baggage of love is, how we suffer, how we don't suffer, what happens to love, then to the extent that we understand this in our own life and our own experiences, we can make wiser choices. We can learn how to love better, love ourselves, love others, and we can learn how to not be so unrealistic about the myth of love in our life, but to be able to acknowledge the simple moments of love that you can have at any time with any person. And I was reading an article recently, they were talking about the micro moments of love that you can have with anyone. And, you know, when you stop and think about it, how many people you meet or you have some contact with in the course of the day, why can't you love them? You know, you go through the checkout counter at the grocery store, there's a person there. There's a real person. What does it take to have, you know, a 20 second hit of shared attunement with that person where you're really connecting at a heart level in real time and out of no expectation, but just an appreciation? Why not? And yet if we miss those opportunities, we can think that we're going through life unloved, unloving, alone, isolated, kind of cut off, kind of like missed something in life. And yet every one of us has dozens of interactions every day that offer us the opportunity to recognize some or many of the elements of love in those interactions. I don't know anything you don't know. So I'm not an expert on love. I'm just an ordinary lover, like all of you. But I think I know something about how to be aware and how to tease apart the elements of experience, and in this case, the elements of love. So the conclusion that I have kind of tentatively reached in my life at this point about love and its value or its meaning or its purpose or its place in my life is that it's a great experiment still going on, because it still happens, it still grows, it still changes. And so I don't think the final word has been said or written on love for any of us. But before we get too far into love, we should really try to define what it is, because so often in literature, love is considered mysterious, ineffable, subtle, beyond words, close to silence. And yet we all know what that experience is when you really feel loved or you feel loving towards someone. And yet it really is quite hard to talk about it. It really is quite hard to put it into words what that experience is. Nevertheless, we should recognize that there are some degree of care for the other person, some degree of a sensitive, deep, whatever that means, connection with the person, or some kind of tuning in to them. And there's some kind of often partiality towards them. We like them, don't just love them. We like them. They're an object of attachment, attraction, affection. And all of these are qualities of heart and mind that come into play in love relationships. Modern scholarship does not always have a flattering opinion of what conventionally passes for love in our culture, the passionate love of adolescence, and it's not only adolescence, but we like to think it is. When they say that, you know, passionate love is really a type of infatuation where you're kind of beguiled by the other person, or you're besotted by the person, or you're suffering under a self-delusion about the nature of the other person. And sometimes they call, you know, passionate love really an obsession, a craze, a mania. And I think that many of us have had that experience when you fall in love, however that happens. When you fall in love, you get a little bit wacky. You know, you get a little bit crazy. You know, you enter a world of two that no one else is privy to, and everything makes sense to you and it looks foolish to everybody else. Plato called that kind of love divine delirium. And we know what he's pointing to, that it's so exquisite, it's so exotic, and it's so erotic, and so euphoric, and it feels like it's divine, like beyond human, normal human experience. So when we talk about love, we don't want to somehow exclude that possibility. We've all had a taste of it to some, most of us have had a taste of it to some degree. Some of us are addicted to that kind of flavor of love, and some of us would like to have a little more of it, but nevertheless, we shouldn't just dismiss it as with some judgment that somebody else offers us, but we should really, if it arrives in your life, be with it, look at it, try to understand what its role is in your life, and what about this is so captivating or so divine, and what about it is so challenging and causing of suffering. Very often when we say I love you to someone, we really mean that I have a lot of affection for you, or I approve of you, or I desire you, or I want what you have. I want you to offer me what you have. And sometimes we don't know. And often there's kind of a myth about love in our society, that somehow as a young person, younger, or maybe at any age, hopefully you can fall in love with someone and sustain this love, this passionate, romantic, erotic, euphoric, divine love for the rest of your life and live happily ever after. Most of us are old enough to know that it hasn't happened yet. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative is what we've actually experienced in our life. And rather than make it wrong or bad, we should look at it and just say, this is the way it is. You know, metta and universal love for all beings, that's great. And the way it is for us is also not bad. historically, romantic love has often been considered a painful affliction, an abnormality, a madness, work of the devil by you know who, craziness or an illusion. Peter Ustinov caught it quite clearly when he says, "I can see from your utter misery, from your eagerness to misunderstand each other, and from your thoroughly bad temper, that this is the real thing." The Native American first generation group known as the Shoshone also knew that romantic love existed in their culture too, but they recognized it for what it was, and in their case they considered it a form of madness. So this is the prejudice that we're up against when we start talking about love in the many ways that we experience it or imagine that we can or should or have. Traditionally, of course, in the Buddhist view of things, if there's any lust or desire or attachment or affection, it's contaminated and it's impure, and you better work hard to get rid of that so that you can have real universal love. But it kind of leaves out the individual. Like, isn't there a personal love, or does it all have to be universal? Can we truly have a genuine, caring, responsive, well-wishing for someone that we're also living domestically with? Or do they have to be far away on the other side of the earth where you really don't see them, and you know, you can have all kinds of good wishes for them? But if we look a little further into the literature of love, we can see that psychologically there's a lot of understanding how valuable the love relationship is for, or let's say the personal love relationship can be for someone. And some go so far as to say that it is love, this personal love of another and from another, that really reveals us to ourselves. That we only come to know parts of ourselves through having this kind of love. Because love so activates the possibilities of self-knowledge that an entire universe, heretofore unknown, offers itself to the wide and curious eyes of a lover. Now maybe you can remember when you had that kind of love relationship and you just started seeing everything as magical and special and unique, and things that were very familiar suddenly looked sparkly in a way that was other than familiar. Because love can give meaning to an entire lifetime, because it sets up resonances, it touches something in the deepest abysses of the heart, of the mind. It pulls on something that is there that we may never have seen before until that kind of love relationship comes into our life. We can get a hint, or we can get a glimpse of what love isn't, or what love is by what it isn't. It isn't withdrawal, it isn't isolation, it isn't alienation, it isn't loneliness, it isn't the loss of intimacy. And so when you know what love isn't, then you get a glimpse of what it is. It's clear that we all have had a lot of love experiences, still have kinds of love experiences, will have more, but the value of these love experiences to us remains to be seen. It depends on how we are treated by them, or how we treat them, what we understand about them, and really how much we are willing to open to and experience them fully, and to learn about ourselves and the nature of love from these experiences, and not to hide from them, not to resist them, not to be so damaged in our prior love relationships that we just don't dare open anymore. We fear that opening of the heart that love requires. Because love, you know, love gone bad is painful, and most of us have had that kind of experience too. And we might think that we're beyond that. Somehow that door is closed to us. And it's not true. It can happen to anyone at any time. There's a great quote I have here. Love is not the exclusive province of adolescence, my dear. It's a heart ailment that strikes all age groups, like my love for you. My love for you is the only malady I've contracted since the usual childhood diseases, and it's incurable. So, I want to speak about the spectrum of love experiences just to kind of remind us all of what it is that we have experienced or will experience. And maybe the first that we all experienced and is most obvious is family love. The love that we have for those in our bloodline. And often it's parents with children, or parents with, or grandparents with grandkids, or us with our parents when they become older and we're caring for them. And it comes with with genetics. Because of somehow being born into this family, there's often a love of kinship, love of kin, that is pretty noticeable. And even a little baby that can't speak and doesn't have words can mirror loving behavior. When the parent is making eye contact and playing with them and smiling and making approving sounds, and the baby can mimic them, then there really is a two-way street going on there. They both are experiencing that kind of love relationship. But there are some limits to that, because it doesn't always work. And the parent is in the caregiver role, is really in the protective, offering some kind of protection and safety and security and education. And really the child is quite helpless. They can mimic, but they can't really initiate much on their own. So it's a kind of love that has its strengths, it has its benefits, but it also has its limitations for the child. As children grow up and they become more autonomous, then as a parent we're not in such a protective or paternal role, and they have a little more autonomy, and we can share other loving emotions with them, like compassion when they're suffering, joy when they have some achievement or some accomplishment that they're happy about. We can have sympathetic joy with them. Or when they're really well established in their own life, either temporarily or in a more enduring way, we can feel a lot of ease in our relationship with them, a lot of equanimity. And these are the four divine abidings, or the Brahma-viharas, that are often taught in Buddhist circles. And they are all expressions of love that come about with our children at different ages or different stages of their development. There's another kind of love that we all have experienced, and I call it instructive love or guiding love. And it's the kind of love that you might have had from a teacher or a benefactor or a mentor at some point in your life. Now here's someone who offers you more than just what's required of their role, but really a personal connection into the kind of the mystery of that particular topic or that particular career or that particular knowledge, where they're offering you really their personal best, if you will. And it's not necessarily a formal role, but it's just a way of relating to those that we are instructing or guiding. Sometimes I, as a teacher, feel it towards students who have a particular, that I just have a particular connection with. Sometimes students feel it for their teacher. I remember when I was in Burma and practicing with one of my monastic teachers there, I didn't really feel, I'm not a very devotional type, I'm not a goo-goo, ga-ga type guy, except with the grandkids. But when my teacher went away on a trip for a few months, each evening I would go to his cottage and listen to a tape recording of one of his talks. And instead of him being there, there was a picture of him in the chair where he usually sat. And then I realized how much I really appreciated him in my life and how valuable he was and how extraordinary his generosity towards me was in sharing the Dharma and guiding me in the practice of awareness training. And then I began to feel this kind of love for him as a benefactor, not just a teacher, but a real benefactor and mentor in my life. It reminded me that when I was younger and in high school and college, I used to work for a fellow who also taught me the inner workings of just being a businessman. And he didn't have a particular angle on it. He just was very willing to share what he knew with me, and I realized how much I also loved him. And so these kinds of relationships, they're not erotic, they're not sexualized, they're not because of kin, but they're because of a specific kind of relationship we have with someone, either as an instructor or guide or mentor or benefactor, or someone who's receiving that kind of knowledge from another. Usually this kind of love and appreciation and caring is not so universal. It's more limited to a few people, and usually the relationship is unequal. You know, the one who's the benefactor has more to offer. The recipient can offer some respect, some appreciation, some gratitude, but there's a difference in the mutuality of those love relationships. A second or third, a fourth kind of love relationship that I became aware of when I was a monk is that by being a monk, I was a Buddhist monk in the monastery, I had an affinity and a connection with all other monks, even from different traditions, Catholic tradition, Zen tradition. There was a feeling of, oh, we have something in common that was unspoken, acknowledged just by our robes, our appearance, our behavior. And even without knowing anything about them personally, I could feel a great sense of connection and appreciation and like spiritual kinship with them. So too with the nuns, but you know, monks and nuns, they can have some kinds of relationship, but they can't have other kinds of relationship. So still you could have that appreciation, that recognition of the commitment that they have, and without knowing them personally, and value and appreciate their commitment and really love that part of them or love them in that way for it. But this is usually a very limited class of people, those that you have a mutual interest in a topic or a way of life. Sometimes people get that kind of relationship with a political party or a country or even their company that they work for. It's kind of a stretch sometimes to say that, but still people can have very strong appreciative, affectionate, approving, loving relationships. And then the big bang is romantic love. And there are a couple of different kinds of romantic, passionate love that I want to speak about. And the first is erotic love. And we've all had some degree of this kind of passionate falling in love, lusting after, wanting to, you know what it is, that kind of wanting to get that person, get that person in your life, if not elsewhere. And of course, there's a tremendous amount of desire, fascination, attraction based on sexual interest. But sometimes that, the power of that, the intensity of that connection is because we're lonely, or because we feel isolated, or we have, we feel very omnipotent, and we can have that kind of relationship towards another. There's a lot of excitement, and there's a lot of anticipation in the unfolding of it. It's not like a very settled, it's not a very calm, as you know. And some say that that kind of erotic, passionate love relationship may be the most intense, pleasurable sensation or experience that humans are capable of. Back now, it's quite a few years ago, I think it was in 91, Nike had an ad campaign. And Nike was the old, you know, running shoe company for guys, and they wanted to expand their line for women. And so they put together this ad campaign, which was contrary to all advertising wisdom at the time. It was a black and white photos, little insert in some of the magazines, some of the upper scale magazines, black and white photos, a lot of writing, very little words, and kind of fuzzy grained pictures. But the title of the little booklet was called Falling in Love, a Passion Play in Six Acts. And the first act was lust. I think I love you, and who are you anyway? And what they wrote was, here it is, the big wow, the big G, the big yes, 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 you've been waiting for. This is where you find someone and you believe they are better, greater, cuter, wiser, more wonderful than anyone you have ever known. Lust isn't a sin, it's a necessity. For with lust as our guide, we can imagine our bodies moving the way our bodies were meant to move, and we can do marathons with our feet, we can lift pounds with our arms, we have stars in our eyes, and we can even do a nifty tango. And you think, I have no need for food. I have no need for sleep. I have no needs other than occasionally chewing a breath mint. You are the best thing that's ever happened to me. Remember that? It's not over yet, folks. Is there any one of us that is so jaded that we can't say that in that kind of connection, there's no love? That's love. There's a lot of baggage with it, but there's that kind of mainlining of some kind of love. Okay, the second kind of romantic love I want to speak about is euphoric romantic love. And this is the kind of romantic love that gets depicted in popular songs, TV shows, movies. It's where we really have this idealization of another person and believe that they can offer everything that we need to be completely satisfied, fulfilled, and accomplished in our life. It often involves a fusion, in a kind of an emotional fusion with another person, where you just kind of meld into the other person, and together the two of you make one person, and you can live happily ever after. Well, that's the feeling. There's a lot of emotional enmeshment, and there's actually often a giving up of one's own autonomy in order to have that kind of euphoric connection. Well, this was Act 2 of Nike's falling in love, a passion play, or act two is called euphoria, or oh yippee, you're mine. You feel funny inside, you feel funny outside, you feel you could do anything and no one would dare laugh at you. This love you will treasure. You will not put it in the basement next to your rowing machine in a treadmill, and you will not take this love for granted, ever. And you say, I feel so good. I feel so strong. I actually feel attractive. And I could learn to live with this feeling. Oh, let us sing and dance. Oh, what joy, what rapture. Remember? You know, it comes at different times, and who can say that there's no love there, that it's just some sort of unwholesome mental state that's just kind of contaminating your true, genuine, pure happiness. But both of these kinds of romantic love have have some unique characteristics that we should identify. First of all, there's a tremendous amount of joy and delight, and often we're in love with the feeling of love itself. We're in love with that feeling. And there's a merging with both of them with another person, which often is a loss of autonomy, and emerging with someone. And this feeling of oneness is accomplished using the same qualities of mind that spiritual seekers use to develop jhanic absorption. All the qualities of mind that are developed to attain jhana, or deep concentrated states in spiritual practice, are present in these kinds of romantic, euphoric, erotic love relationships. Except the object is different. Instead of it being a meditative object, it's a person and the pleasure you experience with them. Nevertheless, we can get pretty concentrated. Right? You know, making love is pretty concentrated. And all the same qualities of mind are there as in the development of spiritual practice. Then there's the kind of love that many of us at this age have experienced in more enduring relationships. More enduring relationships can be 5 years, can be 10 years. And as I've given these teachings over the last couple of weekends in different places, there have been some couples that have 30, 40, and 50 years, even 60 years in Sacramento, 60 years of married life. And there's got to be some love there, you know. But it's not this steady, erotic, passionate, euphoric love. It's something else. It's some kind of domestic love that has a very refined, where the two people have a very refined attunement with one another. They have a lot of shared awareness, shared identity, shared kind of an openness and some level of transparency with one another. And there's just tremendous care and appreciation and often a lot of gratitude for the other person being in their life. And these are all elements of a very long-term, committed relationship. There can also be some blind spots. You know, there are places that we just have kind of carved off from the relationship and just say, you know, we just don't go there. And it allows you to kind of live together the way you do and just kind of avoid that section. But in that attunement, in that shared intimacy and awareness, there's this very strong feeling of being connected to and feeling that you understand the other person. And not only that you understand the other person, but that they understand you. And when there's that reciprocal or mutual ease in the relationship, then the shared awareness and the shared intimacy just can really sustain itself. And at that time, when there's that kind of sharing, there's kind of, you care about the other's satisfaction, security, safety, ease, as much as you care about it for yourself. Periodically. Not all the time, but periodically. That's really the kind of love that you have. And the feeling of well-being, the sense of well-being that we have when we're able to offer that to the other, or when we feel it being offered to us by the other, is tremendous. You just really feel cared for and really safe and secure in your role and in your place in life. Voltaire spoke about this, or wrote about this, when he said, "Sensual pleasure passes and vanishes in the twinkling of an eye, but the friendship between us, the mutual confidence, the delight of the heart, the enchantment of the soul, these things do not perish and can never be destroyed. I shall love you until I die." And sometimes in long, committed relationships, you can see that, you can feel that, you can recognize that the intensity of the passion passing away, but that there's some deeper connection that holds us in loving relationship. There's another kind of love I want to speak about, and I've become aware of it through literature and otherwise, but I've never heard it really talked about in this way, so it's kind of not really my own invention, but just a way I want to talk about a kind of love. And I call it karmic love, or epic love. And the characteristics of it are that it often involves meeting someone, and even at the first moment of meeting them, you feel or you know that you've known them for a long time, whatever it is. And often the connection between those two people is so strong that they're willing to step outside of society's permission. Think Richard Burton, Liz Taylor. Who could say they didn't have a karmic connection, for better or worse, that entertained a lot of us for a few decades? I mean, it was so hot that even the Catholic Church had to really kind of put them in their place and really condemn them for their behavior. I mean, that's intense. Nevertheless, it does happen that sometimes two people will connect on what feels like a plane or a level of knowing each other that is beyond whatever this lifetime has to offer. And I want to read one account of what I call this epic love. And it's a story about an experience written by John Barlow, who was a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. And he wrote about his experience. Now, John Barlow was the fellow who wrote the lyrics to "Looks Like Rain." Now, "Looks Like Rain" is just a great love song by the Grateful Dead, which is just very popular, and a lot of people recognize it as one of their love songs. So he says, "When I wrote "Looks Like Rain," I had never fallen in love before. I had certainly heard a lot of love songs, and I'd been to many operas, but I was not unfamiliar with the huge literature of amorous helplessness. But I remained skeptical. I secretly believed that falling in love was a conceit that people had made up in order to make themselves even more miserable for their perceived insufficiencies. People do stuff like that, you know. Nevertheless, there was this song coming into being one day, one winter day in Wyoming, and I didn't try to stop it from coming into existence merely because it trafficked in emotions I hadn't experienced. I didn't know who these people in the song were, or really, what they were experiencing, but as the song arrived, it seemed as genuine as any other love song. That was in 1972. 21 years later, I fell in love for the first time in my life. I looked across a crowded room and I saw somebody's back, and I knew. Don't ask me how I knew. Don't even ask me what it was I knew. Now, mind you, this was after I'd had about 200 people come up to me in various contexts and tell me that Looks Like Rain was the song that they fell in love to, or was a song that they played at their wedding, or was a song that changed their lives and helped them to feel like one person. I would nod and smile as if I knew what they were talking about. In any event, I was instantaneously in love with some person whose face I hadn't yet seen. She turned around and fell in love with me. We were both so convinced of this emotional reality that a week after we met, we were living together, even though she was freshly married at the time to a far likelier candidate for the position. She was also an improbable deadhead, a sleek young psychiatrist who preferred black Armani suits to tie-dyes and had never smoked pot in her life. In fact, she'd grown up making particular fun of hippies, particularly old ones like me. After we'd been together for almost a year, enjoying a relationship so radiant that others would gather around it like cats to a fireplace, we were at a Dead concert in Nassau Coliseum, of all grim places. Bobby Weir of the Grateful Dead started to sing Looks Like Rain, and I started singing it to her myself so that she would get all the words. About halfway through, I realized that I was getting it, getting all the words for the first time. I finally knew what that song was about. I finally meant it, or perhaps one could say more accurately that it finally meant me. Both of us were crying by the time it was over, and we didn't even know why we were crying yet. About 3 weeks later, I put her on a plane in Los Angeles, 2 days before her 30th birthday. She went to sleep almost immediately. When the flight steward tried to wake her up to tell her to put her seatbelt on as they descended into JFK, he found that she had died, and had been so since the beginning of the flight. The flu we'd both been suffering from when I sang that song to her had attacked her heart and given her viral cardiomyopathy. She fibrillated in her sleep. She flew away as angels sometimes do, and I still sing her love songs. So there's that kind of love too. And then to wrap up the spectrum, there's spiritual love. There's the love that Rumi speaks about, the love of the beloved. And really, it's the love of love itself that Rumi speaks about when he says, "Look, I tried everything, but nothing was lovelier than you. And when I dived into the ocean, there was no pearl like you. I opened 1,000 vats and barrels and tasted them all, but never was intoxicated by any wine but you." How strange. Really, what he's talking about is the just being in love with love itself. And maybe all spiritual traditions, I can't speak for all spiritual traditions, but certainly in that tradition, and even in our Buddhist tradition, there is spiritual love that is really, in some ways, mystical, a mystical union with love itself, sometimes a mystical union with God, or with love, or with all beings, as in loving kindness. And the feeling of oneness is one of the characteristics, where there really is no separation between you and anyone else. and that is the direction that loving kindness or metta takes you. It's also the kind of, it's also the direction that Rumi's love took him. And with that connectivity with all beings, there's a real loosening or a dropping of your own limited self-identity. And one merges with the universe or the universal or the whole or the one, however you understand it. And this too can be an intoxicating experience, as much as passionate erotic love. And at times, even in practicing loving kindness, one can arouse intense, pleasurable, ecstatic, blissful feelings similar to the physical and emotional, mental feelings of erotic and passionate love. And these are different kinds of, I guess, or different degrees of spiritual love or development of the spiritual element in love that sometimes we experience. And it can be felt sometimes just in nature. You walk out in nature, you walk out into the redwood forest of Northern California, and it just takes your breath away. You get it. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to do any spiritual practice. You just get it. It's like, okay, wow. You can call it God, you can call it love, you can call it universal, anything you want, but there's a kind of connection, a kind of attunement, a kind of a refinement. You disappear into the immensity of all it is, and it's lovely. It's just love. So these are some of the kinds or experiences of love that we've all had. And some of them, of course, are temporary, thank goodness. Some of them are painful because, let's face it, in our love relationships, we've been abandoned, we've been jealous, we've been fearful of loss, we've been while we have experienced love, we've also experienced the baggage, the suffering of the baggage of love. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't consider it love, or that we shouldn't keep trying, or that we should kind of somehow judge it as inferior in any way. It is the way it is. And if we're going to practice awareness to really understand our life, when these experiences come into view, we have to acknowledge them, not sit in judgment of them, or not kind of poo-poo them, or not have a cynical or caustic or sarcastic view of them. They are what they are. And for each one of us at different times, they are intense, loving experiences. And they need to be acknowledged that way. And we can learn from them. Because to the extent that we learn about these experiences, the baggage, the suffering of the baggage, then we can make wiser choices in our life. So thank you for listening. If you have any questions, sometimes people don't like to ask questions on this topic in public, but nevertheless, if you dare, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to comment on them or answer them. We'll see. Yeah. Do you want to? Yeah. Okay. So, if you could just state your name, your age, your sexual preference, you know, whether you're married, single, divorced, widowed, or and whether you're available for a love relationship or not. No. Okay. Yeah, okay. Sure. So the comment is, look, if you take your mindful awareness investigation into the erotic, euphoric part of falling in love, it's kind of like a buzzkill. You know, it's like, blah, you know. That's not what I mean. But can you say that you want to fall in love and not be aware of what's going on? No, you want to be there. So it's like, I would say, take your mindful awareness into those experiences for what they are. We're not trying to look at them through the lens of, you know, any Dharma teaching or anything else, but just what is it that you're experiencing at that time? You're experiencing a lot of fantasy, you're experiencing a lot of pleasure, you're experiencing a lot of a sense of this is going to last forever, eternity. You know, impermanence goes out the door when you fall in love. It's just like, you know, when you fall in love, you sustain that love because you know it's going to last forever. Okay, don't start reflecting on impermanence. Just instead, no. Instead, notice what is actually happening. What's actually happening is you have a sense of this is eternal. Okay, what's that feel like? Can you be with that? Okay, and then, you know, along with this kind of love, you know, this kind of fascination with the other person, at some point, the dark side of the moon is going to rise, you know, and they're not going to look quite like they did before. Okay, notice that. So rather than trying to impose an understanding on it or an experience on it, just see it for what it is as it happens. And during the first phase, you know, of falling in love and the euphoria and, you know, erotic, exotic, whatever. Okay, so, you know, you're a little bit lost. That's okay. It's not going to last forever. It's just not. You may think so. Just notice that. You know, because if we cut it off prematurely, if we shut it off prematurely, we're not going to know for sure, right? If you kind of out of spiritual athleticism, just kind of lay on this heavy spiritual wrap about, no, this isn't good, you know, you better put that aside, this is headed for trouble, you're going to suffer with this, then you don't check it out. And all of us have checked it out, so we missed that teaching, right? We can learn from our experience. We don't have to just accept the book. And in fact, you have to learn from your own experience. So the way we learn is by being aware. So as it happens, be aware of it. Some of you will have more, you know, insight into impermanence and dukkha earlier on in the relationship than other times, but, you know, okay, let it happen. Let it rip. You know, don't give up your life. Okay.
Then what about the love is blind?
What about love is blind? Well, what are you talking about?
I mean, if you say if you're seeing, you see what's happening, but then you can't say the love is blind.
Let me just ask you, is love blind? Huh? What's your experience?
It's not. It's just a saying.
That's a saying. There's a lot of sayings out there if you want to go, you know. So I can't comment on sayings. You know, I can comment on experiences. Tell me what your experience is, and I can tell you if there's awareness there or not. But I think You know, if we take these cliches about love, whether love is blind or love is bliss or love is eternal, or some of the lyrics, my God, some of the lyrics that we have been put into our hard drive, you know, from songs way back, they are powerful. But they're powerful expressions of feelings. The feelings. And we all have those feelings. You don't have to believe them as a literal, but you have to recognize the feeling that these lyrics are pointing to, because when you fall in love, that's the feeling. And the lyrics kind of capture the feeling. So we don't have to be afraid of love songs, but we have to be aware of what we're experiencing when you hear love songs, popular love songs. You know, it's not literal. You know, literal is like buzzkill, okay? But if you understand what the feeling is behind it, then you have that feeling. That's what you need to get in touch with. Other comments or questions? Come on.
Well, I guess I kind of get disturbed and distressed by a lot of what you said, and I can't quite understand them. And I've experienced all of those kinds of love, so it sounds like I don't understand what you're talking about. But can you talk a little bit about what you see as the difference between lust and love? Or if you do see, if you do see a difference. And part of my distress about what you're saying is that with just lust, there's a, I think that sometimes there's a not caring. And that to me is not synonymous with love.
Right.
I mean, I'm not trying to be naive.
No. I appreciate your courage in just acknowledging what you've acknowledged, because it is confusing. When we fall in love, there's often a lot of lust, right? Okay, so we can't say that they're synonymous, of course not, but they come together often. Sometimes it's just pure sex without any love, you know. It's just like, get it on, get it over, you know. No love, no care, no. There's that kind of lust, of course. And then there's the falling in love kind of lust, where you really do have attraction, affection, caring, sensitivity, connectivity, shared awareness, shared intimacy, and lust. Okay, don't deny any of it. That's the experience. Check it out. Check out the fullness of the experience. And by the way, if you do just get caught in lust and you're just really horny and you just want to go get it on, get it off, great. Be aware of that. Hello? We're human. This is the way it is sometimes. Right? Okay. And it's not going to be that way forever. I know. So it happens. So, right? So I'm not saying one is better or one is worse. I'm saying you can learn from anything. And if there's love with lust, great, learn about that. Learn about both of them. If there's lust without love, learn about that. Why should we accept the judgment of anyone else when we can find out for ourselves through our own awareness and our own experience? That's why I'm not teaching you about love. I'm teaching you about awareness. Yeah?
I have one follow-up.
Yeah. Yeah, please.
Just about some of those levels of evolving seems to me that it would be hard to be aware of maybe some deep level of honesty. And maybe I'm just talking about myself.
Yeah.
Obviously.
agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're talking about authenticity, honesty, and in some of those kinds of love, what we conventionally call love experiences, it may not be so much honesty. Notice that. Be aware of that. That in this kind of love relationship, I'm really not very honest, either with myself or with the other person. There's not that level of intimacy. Okay, some of them have very different levels. They're across that spectrum, there's very different levels of intimacy with oneself and with the other. Some of them are, you know, could be not very self-loving either. You know, you can be really dishonest and manipulative. And I'm not suggesting that that's good or better or worse. I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying when it happens to you that way, be aware of it and learn about it. Okay? That's the whole point, is learn from it. Don't just accept society's judgment or your particular spiritual tradition's judgment that that's a no-no. I mean, we don't have to go looking for any of these things. They land in our lap. Okay? So learn from them. Yeah? That's all I'm saying. I think that sometimes we can, you know, after you've been through a few love relationships and kind of getting a little jaded by it, it's like you get a little cynical. You're just like, yeah, right. You know, you get that kind of, you know, it's a mess, don't go there. Or, you know, you just, it's for young, naive kids, not for us 65-year-olds who are naive. You know, not as naive as we used to be, but still naive, you know. Yeah. Self-centeredness.
And narcissism.
Narcissism.
And those things can grow beyond that into what we would know as love, which is to be more concerned for the other than just for yourself.
Yes.
But what also concerned me in the talk tonight is that we're not talking about how the Dhamma. We're not talking about how the Dhamma.
How the Dhamma. Yeah.
Intersects with love. That is, when we think that our identity, our very life, is dependent upon this feeling or this other being or whatever, when there's that kind of clinging, mm-hmm. isn't that sex is not okay, or that love is not okay, or that falling in love is not okay?
Sure.
If falling in love brings out in me, as it has, the kind of clinging that is self-destructive,
yeah.
it keeps me really away from myself.
Yeah.
I'm
glad you learned that from your own experience.
I learned it from my own experience. Yeah.
Right.
And the Dhamma has reinforced it
yeah.
such that I know that all clinging, whether we call it, I cling because I love so much.
Yeah, right.
You know, or I cling because it's so wonderful. Or
yeah.
because I don't want it to end, or I don't want it to die.
Yeah, sure.
As good.
Yeah.
So I just want to say that that's a missing piece tonight, which is not about spirituality saying that love, sex, attraction,
infatuation
is bad. It's what we do with that in our mind and heart and how we engage self and what's really real.
Yeah. There are, thank you very much for that comment. There are pitfalls all along the way in all of these kinds of love relationships I talk about. There's a lot of baggage. I didn't identify it all. It's just time limit. But as we pay attention to these things that we conventionally call love relationships, we're going to see, just as you have, that this is very self-abusive, or it's very objectifying the other person, or it really does lead to tremendous amount of suffering. And because we have paid attention and discovered that for ourselves, we can get guidance from the Dharma. Thank goodness. I mean, we're not inventing this whole thing for the first time, you know. We've got a lot of advice from wise and aware beings of what works, what doesn't, what's skillful, what's not. And yet we still find ourselves learning for ourselves whether this is true or not, and how it is or how it isn't. And, you know, let's face it, some people get caught and lost and they leave the Dharma and they don't come back for a while. They get, you know, entangled in a way that's pretty lost. You know, I've seen fundamentalist Christianity. I've seen fundamentalist Buddhism. I've seen fundamentalist Muslim. Really damaging. You know, really, really damaging to individuals. And I think that the power of awareness as we are learning it, and the power of, you know, being willing to and have the courage to take your awareness into your experience, whatever it is you're experiencing. And it can be pretty depraved, but take your awareness with you and you'll learn. You'll learn, eventually you'll learn what is suffering and what causes suffering, and you'll stop. You know, but if you are just kind of prohibited by law or religion or authority from looking at your very human experience, that's damaging. That's really, really damaging. So there's a balance. Yes, we have to train it. We have to teach our kids. We have to train our kids. We have to guide our kids. Be careful. Don't go there without your awareness. And they'll still do what they do, as just as we have. But hopefully, we will continue to have the opportunity to learn by ourselves, for ourselves, from our own experience. And that to me is the value of awareness. And of course, using the guidance of Buddhist teachings or any other teachings to kind of give you some guidance what you're looking at. But I think that each one of us is responsible for coming to our own knowledge about what's love and what's not, what's baggage and what causes suffering, what causes real, genuine and enduring well-being and happiness. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for your comment. Time's up.